Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Disciple Makers podcast. This is your host, Tom Hallman. The painful truth about our world is that life is full of suffering. And so reasonable people ask, how could a good and powerful God allow this suffering? At the 2016 Disciple Makers Fall Conference, Dave Kiefer discusses how the foundations of Christianity provide credible answers to the problem of suffering, along with unique resources for our suffering. Here's Dave.
If you're here this morning, it's probably because either you have suffered, you are currently suffering, or you will suffer, or maybe you know someone who is really going through a difficult time of suffering. And suffering presents huge challenges, both intellectually and emotionally. And this morning, what we want to do, hopefully by God's grace, is to start to talk about and address some of those challenges to the head as well as to the heart and show how Christianity in particular provides just very powerful and unique resources for those who are going through deep, deep suffering. I want to open by sharing a story about some friends of mine that I'm actually writing a book about. Brent Nicopole. Brent has my liver. I went through a liver transplant back in 2002. Brent has cheated death four times. And it's amazing to see how this man has found hope in the midst of his suffering. I'm going to play the video, and then we'll get started.
So Brent and I had been friends for a long time, and he asked me if we wanted our relationship to become more serious. And I said, yes, I was interested in that. He had captured my heart a long time ago. We went out to dinner, and then he took me for a walk, and he put a pill in his hand, and he showed me this pill, and he said, I want you to know about this disease I have.
Nick and I have been married 17 years. Over most of those years, I've had a lot of different medical problems. I've had two transplants, several fertility treatments. I spent 9 months on dialysis, 9 or 10 different stays in the hospital, totaling 75 or 80 days. During all of these things, God has really been the main thing to keep us going.
You know, you don't have to look very far to see the cries of the suffering. Just go on Facebook, and you'll see people basically just share their pain. Why did my mom have to get cancer when I was so young and die? Why did my dad leave our family for another woman that we knew nothing about? Why did 250,000 people have to die in a tsunami that happened in the Indian Ocean and killed people, families wiped out, just a whole generation of people? And the question is what hope do we have for the suffering we see in the world, for the suffering we see in our families, among our friends, and for the suffering that we endure ourselves? You know, I've suffered in my life, not like some of you. This past Wednesday, I was hanging out with a friend of mine for 15 years, an elder in our church, Paul Trask, who was diagnosed with ALS. I visit him weekly. I was reading to him from Isaiah and praying for him because Paul can't read, Paul can't talk. Paul can't eat, Paul can't walk, Paul can't do anything. He is stuck in bed all day. He can't even smile or communicate in any way. And the question is, how can we trust in a God who allows so much seemingly senseless and harsh and critical and chronic suffering. I want to first of all talk about the problem of pain and suffering as we face it. I want to talk about it, first of all, by addressing the questions of the head and then talking about the questions of the heart. So first, the questions of the head. The intellectual philosophical problem of suffering and evil has been recognized since at least the time of Epicurus, 300 years before Jesus Christ walked on the earth. Skeptic David Hume states it this way: is God willing to prevent evil but not able? Then he must be impotent. Or is he able but not willing? Then he must be malevolent. Is he both able and willing to prevent evil? Well, then whence, then, is evil? This has been called the argument against God from evil. And for most of history, it's been posited by philosophers. But Charles Taylor points out that the argument against God from evil never had anything like popular appeal until the Enlightenment. Something changed in the Enlightenment. And what changed was humanity's understanding of their ability to comprehend the universe. That we thought that we could completely understand things through human reason, through technology, through science, that science would eventually unlock every secret of the universe. And up until about the 1980s, the argument against God from evil was considered among at least the academic elite to be conclusive proof that the traditional God of the Bible, who is all good and all powerful, could not exist. John Mackey, in his oft-reprinted article, Evil and Omnipotence, wrote, "It can be shown not merely that religious belief lacks rational support, but there are positively no rational support. It is irrational." But see, things began to change starting in the 1970s, when a man named Alvin Plantinga wrote a book, God, Freedom, and Evil. And his book planted a seed that started philosophers thinking in a very different way. Plantinga convincingly argued that the existence of evil is not logically incompatible, even in the broadest sense, with the existence of an all-powerful, all-knowing, and perfectly good God. And this philosopher's ideas were so effective that over the next 25 years, the idea that evil disproves the existence of God, wrote William Austin, is now acknowledged by almost all sides to be a completely bankrupt ideology. See, the fact is, evil and suffering isn't evidence against God. Just because we don't understand evil and suffering doesn't mean there's no good reason for it. Evelyn Underhill said it this way: if God were small enough to be understood, he wouldn't be big enough to be worshipped. But there's more. In fact, logically speaking, evil and suffering seems to be evidence for God. How so? Logically speaking, where do we get the idea of just and unjust in a completely naturalistic, atheistic world? See, there is no ought in nature. What basis does the naturalist have for moral outrage? Survival of the fittest is just what it is. There is no place for oughts. There is no basis to call something good or evil. So naturalism removes the right for moral outrage. We may not approve of rape, but if the goal of the human experiment is to pass on your genetic code, who are you to say it's wrong for a man to rape a woman to pass on his genetic code? We know, on the other hand, that God allows for our suffering to produce good ends. In fact, he uses it to often change us and make us into wiser and better people. And sometimes, while we look back and say, if I had it to choose over, I still wouldn't choose the pain, but honestly, I'm thankful for the way God used that suffering in my life. 2 years ago, my wife and I had been seeking to adopt a fourth child, and we had been waiting for years for this little baby. And we were down at the Washington Zoo. We got a call. We have a baby for you. We came home. We rushed home. We filled out all the paperwork to get this thing moving. And a day later, they said the birth mom changed his mind. And then a month later, we got another call, another opportunity. And this time, everything was going great. And we brought home a baby girl who we named Mia. And all of our older kids were allowed to bond with this girl. And I remember my daughter Kelly going, God answered my prayer. I wanted a baby sister and he gave me one. We're like, yeah, honey, God answers prayer. And then God took baby Mia away from us. And I remember when I had to go and drop her back off at the adoption agency. And I drove home and I went into my room and I just fell in a fetal position and cried for hours, crying out, why, God, have you allowed this? Sometimes it just doesn't make sense, does it? But we know, sometimes looking back, that God has unexpected surprises. Because just a couple months later, we got a call, a two-for-one, that there was an older sibling group, and we're reinterested. And we were so heartbroken, but we had said we were only open to adoption for another month, and I don't know why. Maybe it was the eggs I ate that morning. I don't know. We said yes. We were insane. We thought we would never be chosen because we already had three kids, but we were chosen, and we brought home a beautiful six-year-old girl and a beautiful four-year-old boy who were broken and a mess. And our kids couldn't understand why they smelled so much after we had given them showers. And we had a hard time explaining to them it was because they were so neglected and abused that their teeth were literally rotting out of their mouth. My son, all his top teeth were rotting to the core. When he ate, it hurt. His mouth was nothing but one huge infection. And so he smelled all the time. What brokenness. And I've never seen kids cry and grieve like those kids cried and grieved. I thought, boy, I've seen kids stubborn in their anger, but not like this. He's got to get tired eventually. See, God surprised us when he took away baby Mia, but then he gave us two kids who over time, God has opened our hearts to these kids. They're our kids. God's remaking them. They couldn't sit for more than 5 seconds. They didn't know their alphabet. Now they're caught up in school. They can make friends. They can speak in ways that people can actually understand them. And I look back and I say, God, why did you do this? This is not what we wanted. We wanted four kids, not five. We don't have the room. God said, let me expand your vision. And you know what? I wouldn't change it for the world. The problem of evil is not an argument against God. If anything, it's an argument for his existence. And we know that the God of the Bible hasn't ended all suffering, but he promises one day that he will. And that he uses our suffering for good, for redemptive purposes. So it's not a problem, at least intellectually, to maintain belief in an all-powerful and good God. The reality of pain and suffering, though, is more than an intellectual problem. The experience of pain and suffering poses an emotional problem that challenges the heart. Some of you may be sitting there saying, so what if evil and suffering doesn't logically disprove God? I'm still angry. All this philosophizing does not get the Christian God off the hook for all the world's evil and suffering. And in response, Peter Kreft points out that the Christian God came to earth to deliberately put himself on the hook for human suffering. Because in Jesus Christ, God experienced the greatest depths of pain. Let me read some of the pain that God endured from Isaiah 53. It's on page 30 there. It says this, who would ever believe this? Who has believed what he has heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant, like a root out of dry ground. He had no majesty or form that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions, not his own. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed. See, all of us, like sheep, we've gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. But the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed. He was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off the land of the living, stricken for the transgressions of the people? In other words, as he's dying on the cross, it doesn't make any sense to them. Who would ever consider that the greatest act of mercy was happening, that he was dying for our transgressions? And they made his grave with the wicked and with a rich man in his death, although he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth. Yet it was the will of the Lord, the will of the Lord. God was sovereign over this. It was the will of the Lord to crush him. He has put him to grief. And when his soul makes an offering for guilt, he shall see his offspring. He shall prolong his days. The will of the Lord shall yet prosper in his hand. Out of the anguish of his soul, he shall see and be satisfied. By his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous, and he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will divide him a portion with the many, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he has poured out his soul to death and was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he bore the sin of many and makes intercession for the transgressors. Jesus experienced the full extent of pain to show us that God is a sympathetic and empathetic God. He doesn't just call us to bear up under suffering and say, keep a stiff upper lip, but he enters into our suffering. He walks in our shoes. In fact, he goes through more suffering than you and I will ever have to face. He is truly an empathetic God who suffers with us. And therefore, you can know you are not alone. And as that melts our hearts, it can begin to allow us to entertain that maybe God is trustworthy, even with the suffering we don't understand, because it is for sure that the disciples and the crowd standing at the base of the cross of Golgotha did not understand what was going on, that could not see any way this could turn out for good. And yet that moment in history has become the defining moment in history, the defining moment of hope, of forgiveness, of redemption, and of the defeat of death as it's gobbled up by the resurrection. So the experience of pain and suffering was shared by our God. Now, how we experience suffering, how we experience it affects the way we feel about it. Listen, not all suffering is the same. There are multiple causes for it, multiple effects. We must recognize the variety of suffering in life. And each kind brings its own set of unique challenges and emotions. Some trials, let's be honest, are brought on by our own wrong behavior and stupidity. The resulting feelings are appropriately shame and guilt. But some suffering is the result of betrayals and attacks by others. And the resulting feeling is anger and resentment. Some suffering is common to all. It's just a universal form of loss that may occur no matter how well we live life, no matter how others treat us. It's like the loss of a loved one, illness, or death. And the result is feelings of grief and fear. Some suffering is just horrific, nauseating, mass shootings, earthquakes, and it results in feelings of shock, confusion, and anger. Anger at God, anger at everyone. See, how we experience suffering affects the way we feel about it, whether it's shame or anger, whether it's grief or fear. But not only that, how we interpret suffering affects how we experience it. Let me say that again. How we interpret our suffering affects how we experience it. Richard Swader points out basically how various cultures throughout history teach their members to be edified through the misery caused by suffering. He says, some cultures teach a moralistic view. These cultures emphasize that pain and suffering stem from the failure of people to live rightly. And there are many versions of this, but the doctrine of karma is the purest expression of it. In other words, if you are suffering now, it's likely that you are just experiencing your just deserts, maybe from a former life. See, because everything must be paid for, and it must be paid for by you before you can enter into eternal bliss. Other cultures teach a self-transcendent view. This view teaches that suffering comes not from past deeds, but from unfulfilled desires. Those desires are the result of you living in an illusion that your individual self is what matters. And there's an Eastern version of this called Buddhism, and there's a Western view of it that came out of the Greek Stoic movement. And the idea is if you just stop desiring, you'll stop suffering, and you experience tranquility. Your suffering is mitigated because it can't harm the real you, because the real you, as you think exists, doesn't actually exist. It's an illusion. And so let go and mellow out. Then there's the fate-destiny view. This teaches that life's circumstances are set and there's nothing you can do about it. It may be set by the stars, as in paganism, and your destiny is set before you are born. Or it could be set by a supernatural force, as in Islam. In these cultures, the way you deal with your suffering is full and total submission to the difficult divine fate set before you. And you must face it without compromise or complaint, because the highest virtue is to just keep a stiff upper lip and be honorable in the midst of suffering. There's dualistic views. These societies teach that there's no one that's really in control. There's no God that's in control. It's really a battleground between good forces and bad forces, and sufferers can be seen as casualties of that war between equal powers of good and evil. And people find hope just by wishing that the good will win. So in summary, moralistic cultures will teach you to live differently. Self-transcendent cultures, to think differently. Fatalistic cultures, to embrace your destiny nobly. Dualistic cultures, to put one's faith in simply being on the right team and hoping they win. And what is common to all of these views is that suffering should not be a surprise, that there are things that you can do to help you move toward the main purpose in life that suffering can teach you, and that you need to take responsibility for how you respond to it. Now, there's another view, the secular view, Western scientific view, that sees the universe as nothing but matter, naturalistic. Only matter, no spirit, no soul, no God, no angels, no demons. And so suffering is the result of material forces only. It is therefore devoid of any purpose. It is not the result of sin or a cosmic battle or high forces determining your destiny. Suffering is simply an accident. It's neither good or evil. Richard Dawkins said it this way in his book, River Out of Eden. He says, the total amount of suffering per year in the natural world is beyond all decent contemplation. In a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, and other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. Suffering is merely chaotic disruption in the secular viewpoint. And for Dawkins and atheists alike, any meaning a person must develop within that worldview is self-made and naturalistic. And if you accept this meaning, it means that it's limited to some material good, some kind of comfort or safety or pleasure. Unfortunately, suffering inevitably blocks the achievement of those life goods. Suffering either destroys them or puts them in great jeopardy. And this leads to our third point. How does Christianity compare? Christianity teaches a complete reversal of the traditional attitudes and a totally different hope than the secular perspective. Unlike moralistic cultures, Christianity insists that not all suffering is explained by wrongdoing. Those who do good often suffer the most. Contra moralism, suffering is not fairly distributed. Unlike karma, Christians believe that suffering is often unjust and disproportionate. Life simply is not fair. That is the lesson of Job. He was a righteous man, and yet he suffered more than just about any other human on the face of the earth. Unlike self-transcending cultures, suffering isn't merely an illusion due to an over-desire or a false belief that you really exist as an individual person. Rather, suffering is a reality. Pain is pain. Pleasure is pleasure. It's not mere tranquility. Contra Buddhism, suffering and evil are real. Unlike fatalistic cultures, there's none of the ancient arrogance in Christianity that quiets the cries of the suffering and says, just keep a stiff upper lip and be honorable in your suffering. Instead, throughout the pages of Scripture, you see the cries of those who are suffering. These cries resonate everywhere throughout the Scriptures, freely, loudly, harshly. And Christians are encouraged to express their grief to God throughout the Psalms. Let me just read to you Psalm 88, verses 14 through 18. O Lord, why do you cast my soul away? Why do you hide your face from me? Afflicted and close to death from my youth up, I suffer your terrors. I am helpless. Your wrath has swept over me. Your dreadful assaults destroy me. They surround me like a flood all day long. They close me in altogether. You, O Lord, have caused my beloved and my friends to shun me. My companions have become darkness. Contra fatalism, suffering is overwhelming. And there is no nobly enduring it. All of us have a breaking point. And unlike the dualistic view, Christianity does not see suffering as a way to work off your sinful debts by faithfully enduring on the good side. See, dualism divides the world into good people and bad people, but Christianity looks at the heart and says, you're all messed up. As Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, the line dividing good and evil cuts through every human heart. And so does the Christian doctrine of grace. It says, while you were yet sinners, before you did anything to love God, Jesus Christ died for you. And unlike the secularistic view, Christianity believes in a personal God who exists, who's sovereign over suffering and evil, and he turns it for good purposes. So contra secularism, suffering is meaningful. So how we interpret suffering affects how we experience it, how we feel about it, what we do about it, how it affects our hope. And there are unique resources that Christianity provides for our suffering, and I want to just give four. I want to recommend this book from Tim Keller. A lot of what I'm sharing today comes from this book. If you are going through a difficult time of suffering, there's a lot of good books you could read. This kind of summarizes the best of all the best. I don't even know if it's on the book table, but I encourage you to look it up on Amazon. But four doctrines of Christianity give us superior resources for facing suffering. The first is belief in a personal, wise, infinite, inscrutable God who actually is in control of the universe. This is far more comforting than the belief that our lives are in the hands of fickle fate, as in the old religions, or random chance, as in the new religion of materialism. That's the first doctrine. The second doctrine is that Jesus, God in the flesh, has come to earth and suffered with us and for us. And this is more comforting than the idea that God is distant and uninvolved, as the deists proclaim. See, God has not let himself off the hook, but he has come to walk through suffering with us. Dan McCartney says it this way: the reason that Christians insist that God can be trusted in the midst of suffering is that God himself has firsthand experience with suffering. Jesus knows what it means to be abused and beaten by the very ones who should have loved him. Thanks, Tom. So the third doctrine of Christianity that gives unique resources to suffering is the doctrine of salvation through faith in Christ's work on the cross, so that we can have assurance of God's love for us and salvation. This is more comforting than the karmic systems of thought. See, we are assured that the difficulties of life are not payment for past sins. Since Jesus has paid for our sin, past, present, and future, when you cry out, God, why are you doing this in my life? Why this unexpected, shocking suffering? You can know it's not God is punishing you. Why? Jesus has already paid for your punishment in full. So that cannot be the reason. You know God is for you. You may not see exactly how he's for you in the moment, but the cross of Jesus Christ proves that God is for you. Martin Luther taught that suffering is unbearable if you aren't certain that God is for you and with you. The secular perspective cannot give you that. Neither can religions that provide salvation through being a virtuous person who does good works. And lastly, the most powerful resource that Christianity gives for us in the midst of our pain and suffering is the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ. Needless to say, the prospect of the resurrection, of a new heaven, a new earth, a new cosmos, is far more comforting than the belief that death takes you away into an impersonal spiritual substance, or it takes away everything. See, in the resurrection, we get more than just a disembodied, ethereal afterlife. We get our bodies back. We get the whole creation back. And we live in a state of beauty where everything works the way it should. And it's better. If you look at the resurrected body of Jesus, it was better. He could enjoy food and enjoy the embrace of his friends, yet still at the same time walk through closed doors. That's cool. I look forward to that. That means heaven is more than just a consolation. Heaven is a restoration. And so we know that suffering is God's enemy. And God can use that enemy for our good. He did it in the cross of Jesus Christ. And if he did it there, and he did it in the story of Joseph, and in the story of Daniel, and the story of the prophets, but if he did it there, he can do it in your life. Acts 2:27-28 says this: in this city of Jerusalem, there were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, Herod, Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the people of Israel, to do whatever your hand and your plan had predestined to take place. See, God was sovereign. He was in control even over something as brutal and harsh and as confusing as the cross of Jesus Christ. And even though we don't understand it, we can trust God. We have seen how God turns suffering on its head. You know, I wonder why Jesus leaves the scars in his hands in his resurrected body. He didn't need to do that. But I think why he did it, and as he goes to his disciples, he says, place your finger here. I think he does that because those nail marks symbolize for the disciples the end of all hope. Never was a darker day than when their hero, the one that they had sworn to follow, was crucified, beaten beyond recognition. They didn't even have the stomach to show up for the crucifixion. They thought their life was over. They were running in fear from the authorities. And Jesus shows up and says, see this symbol, the thing that you thought was destroying me? The darkest time in humanity? I want to let you know that this has become the very thing that causes evil to rebound, to backfire on itself, and to give a unique and utter hope in the darkest moment when you thought, God can't be at work. I was working more powerfully than you can imagine. God turns suffering on its head. Listen, gang, there are at least four things that are not readily available without suffering. Knowledge of yourself. Do you want to know who you really are? It's really difficult to know who you really are unless you've been tested. And suffering will test you like no else. Do you want to be a compassionate person, full of love, who skillfully helps the hurting? There's no way to really empathize with people unless you have suffered yourself. Do you want to have such a profound faith and trust in God that you are fortified against the disappointments in life? There is no way to really learn to trust God or to know that you do until there's no one left to trust. Do you want to simply be wise about how life really goes, not naively optimistic? Suffering opens your eyes to the deep brokenness of the world caused by sin and Satan, but it's also the way you learn how God works in those darkest places and brings about His redemption. So Christianity provides huge resources. And I want to give us an opportunity just to sort of process these truths together. So we're going to move into a time of Q&A. And we have some mic runners here. So have at it. What questions do you have about suffering?
How did you approach the suffering you had with your kids?
How did I approach the suffering I had with my kids? Poorly. Yeah. You know, one of the things I appreciate about the Bible is that the people of God are called Israel. And do you know what Israel means when you translate it into the English? He who wrestles with God. My little wrestler. And most of the suffering in my life I don't handle in a very poised way. I get angry. And I wrestle with God. And I bang on his chest. But he's got a pretty big chest. He can take it. And I feel confident to do that because that's, throughout the scriptures, what men of faith and women of faith have done. God calls us to wrestle him. He knows that we're angry. He knows that we're upset. So it does no use hiding it from him. What he says is dangerous is if we deny that and run. We deny our grief, or if we don't wrestle it with him. But as long as we're wrestling with him, we're wrestling in a good spot. And as I did that, I just saw Christ, and Jesus just melts my heart. And he gives you unexpected grace for the day. And he gives you little glimpses of how he's going to surprise you with good news that you didn't anticipate. And he leads you to a place where you're like, you know, I wouldn't have chose this for myself, but I'm actually very thankful it went this way. Good question.
So, in the midst of the wrestling, like, what are some passages that you look to and cling to?
Mm-hmm. That's great. A lot of the Psalms. The Psalms give us the whole range of human experience and emotion. Psalm 78, Psalm 88, Psalm 39, Psalm 42. Really wrestling with the Lord. Proverbs talks a bit about the way life normally works. You know, normally if you save up your money and plan your ways, you'll be financially stable. But Ecclesiastes is sort of the balance to Proverbs, because Ecclesiastes says, well, life doesn't always work that way. You might save and you might be really wise and someone might just come and take it away. You might meet a man named Bernie Madoff, and he'll really screw you over. And so you turn to things like Ecclesiastes to see for the times when life really goes wrong, and you can find a lot of wisdom there. The story of Job tells a very confusing, very frustrating real-life story. It's the earliest story where we as the reader get to see why God is allowing suffering in Job's life. In the first three chapters, we're actually told why that is. And that's because Satan goes to God and said, you have all these people that love you, God, but they don't really love you. They love you because you protect them. They love you because of all the good things you give them. They love you because you make their life easy and wonderful. But you take away all the gifts that you've given them, they will curse you to your face. And God says to Satan, well, have at it. Because I think that Job loves me just for who I am, not for what I give him. And so round one, God takes away, you know, Job's kids and all his wealth. And Job responds, blessed be the name of the Lord. He gives and he takes away. I'm going to praise him because he's worthy of praise, not because he just gives me good stuff. And that story is a hard story, but it's a great story to wrestle through. And that's the easier round. The second round, when he goes after his body, that's when you get these long dialogues. It's very confusing. But as you navigate through that, God works his spirit into your heart to see that the thing that Job demanded, which was an explanation he didn't get, yet somehow he was okay with that. And the things that Job's friends demanded, which was condemnation, Job, you must have morally messed up or else God couldn't treat you like this. God defends Job and says, no, Job was a righteous man. He did nothing to deserve this. And you're in the wrong. And so Job's a great, great one.
Follow-up question from that, Dave, is so when someone goes through suffering and through the examples you gave, like with your kids and such, and even just I think the experience we all have of suffering, even in Job, the emotions are complicated. And in one moment, you can feel very confident. You know, the holes in his hands, that's a promise. You know, in the next moment, you're weeping. And so maybe for those of us who are trying to minister to those who have gone through suffering like that, do you have any suggestions for what should we do and what shouldn't we do?
That's a great question. 1 Corinthians 13, 1 through 4, talks about the power of love. And if you want your knowledge and wisdom to be translated to someone so it's actually useful, it has to be grounded in love. If you want your words not to be annoying and irritating, it needs to be grounded in love. He says, if I speak in the tongues of men and of angels but have not love, I'm a noisy gong and a clanging cymbal. And even our service, you know, if I lay down my body to the flames but have not love, I am nothing. Even your service for another person can be useless if it's not grounded in love, if it's grounded in just dutiful guilt. And so the first thing is we need to force feed ourselves the love of Jesus Christ, because that's what's going to transform us, to speak with love, to know with love, to serve with love, to be compelled by his love. It's going to mean a lot of listening. It's going to be practicing God's presence. It reminds me of a story. I have it here. Let me see if I can find it. A story of a man named Joseph Bailey who lost three of his sons at various times in his life. And he wrote about his grief in a book called The View from a Hearse. Bailey writes, "I was sitting, torn by grief. Someone came and talked to me of God's dealings, of why it happened, of hope beyond the grave. He talked constantly, and he said things I knew were true. I was unmoved, except to wish he'd go away. And he finally did. But another came and sat beside me. He didn't talk. He didn't ask leading questions. He just sat beside me for an hour or more, listening. And when I said something, answered briefly, prayed simply, and left. I was moved. I was comforted. I hate it to see him go." Does that help with your question? Good question. A couple more.
How would you recommend that people react when you're suffering and someone just responds to your suffering in a very unhelpful way, or like in that moment when that man was being talked to by a guy who it just sounds like he was not very empathetic and wasn't really understanding and was more preaching at him, like as the person who is in the suffering role, how would you recommend that you can best respond in a Christ-glorifying way?
Well, you probably first have to be convinced that even if you don't, God still loves you and God's still for you. Because like Martin Luther said, if you're doubting that, you're certainly going to doubt other people are for you. You know, Jesus said, "Come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I'm gentle and lowly in heart, and you'll find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light." And when we are yoked to Jesus, no matter what other people pile on in the name of helping, it empowers us to carry that burden with more poise and grace. When we understand his presence, his goodness, it gives us the ability to forgive and offer grace. Like Dave said tonight, this morning, Dave Royce, right? Inasmuch as the grace of God, the amazing grace of God, gets down into our heart, it gives us the ability to offer it to others who certainly don't deserve it.
This might seem like a more straightforward answer, but how should we seek the church or social support in suffering or in depression or any of these?
That's a great question. How should we seek support? Yeah, Jesus puts us in a body, and he calls us to be part of that body, and he actually says that while he's the head, we are the hands and the feet. And oftentimes in the midst of suffering, I don't know about you, my temptation is I want to be alone, I want to be in a closet, I want to pull away from other people, because I know any help they offer is going to be imperfect and possibly annoying and difficult, and I just don't want to deal with them. But Jesus says, that's the help I offer, and it will minister to your soul. Don't unplug from the body. You will be ministered to deeply, helpfully, even though it's imperfectly. Don't unplug. Those are his hands. Those are his feet. That's the way Jesus will embrace you. And not only will you be ministered to, but the people that are ministering to you will be changed. And that's how God changes them and enables them to be better at coming along suffering people and giving them true grace and strength. But it's simply not an option to just unplug and say, I'm not going to church. Screw them, self-righteous people. Been there. Sometimes the hardest thing to do is go to church. Not because of Jesus, because of his people. Great question.
I think for those who have been either abused or neglected, it can create this emotional and intellectual problem that God the Father would neglect or abuse his son, Jesus. So how would you speak to that intellectual and emotional problem?
That's a great question. Yeah. One of the arguments that I think is well stated, and I think it's a fair-minded question, is how could I trust a God who abuses his son the way God the Father abused Jesus Christ? I mean, is it okay for me to abuse my son? I mean, I call that child abuse. And the answer to that is Christianity has always held that Jesus voluntarily gave up his life, and he wasn't just human, he was God himself. And forgiveness is always, always, always costly sacrifice. Forgiveness means instead of you paying your debt, I pay your debt. The debt has to be paid. It doesn't go away. Either you pay it, that's justice, or I pay it, that's forgiveness. We know this is true. The bigger the debt, the more costly the sacrifice to pay it. This is true economically, it's true relationally. And so when we look at the cross of Jesus Christ, we should expect that it's going to cost God a lot to forgive us. Because that's how forgiveness works. If you're going to forgive someone, it's going to cost you. And so we must understand it in light of that, that Jesus is voluntarily paying the cost, and it costs him dearly. He is taking it out of his own flesh so he doesn't have to take a pound of our flesh. That is love. And it's a misunderstanding to see it as divine child abuse. One more question.
Sometimes when we're ministering to people who have been hurt or go through suffering, who are Christians, I feel like there's one of two things that most people do, and it's either you're going to rely on God and trust in him more through that, or some people abandon God.
Right.
Even though they might have grown up in the church and they're Christians and they know this stuff, how can we take, as ministers, a new or fresh approach to them to kind of re-inspire that love for God so that they might come back to that place where they can rely on him?
Well, first of all, I want to point out the wisdom of your observation, which is suffering, you know, the heat. It's like the sun, right? It comes into our lives, and when heat comes into our lives, it can either melt us or it can harden us. It just depends on the state of our heart, right? Heat melts wax, it hardens clay. And so a lot of people are hardened in their understanding of God through suffering, while other people go through the exact same suffering and they feel closer to God and trust God more. So that's a great, wise observation, and it's true. Now, your question is, how do we?
Is there something we can do as disciples that might help revitalize that?
Yeah, I mean, there's limits of what we can do. We're frail, you know, messed up human people that do the best we can. The best we can do is represent the Lord as well as possible and forgive when we don't. But we have to recognize our utter, total, complete dependence on the Lord to get to the heart. And poise comes from the fact that we don't have to manage it. We don't have to control it. I can't change a person. I cannot, you know, it's funny when you're a counselor, you actually become a much more potent, influential counselor when you realize you can't actually change anyone. It takes the pressure off. Because people smell manipulation a mile away. When I recognize I can't change your heart, I can't even change my own heart. Well, then I could just come alongside you and wrestle with you and say, yeah, I don't know. Job didn't know why he suffered. I don't know. this is hard, and I can just weep, and I can just represent the Lord and trust that the Lord promises to work through that. Not just when I do it well, but when I do it poorly. So I think the real answer to your question is we can't change anyone, but as long as we understand God can, we get on our knees for him, and then we do what we can just to represent him. And it keeps us free from manipulating people. Great question. Hey, guys, thanks for your time. These are great questions. Let me close this in prayer. God, thanks for being a God who enters into our suffering. Thanks for being a God who ends suffering. And thanks for being a God who turns suffering on its head so that the things that we thought were going to destroy us may be the very things that transform us into wiser, better, holier people. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
You've been listening to Teaching from Disciple Makers. To learn more about Disciple Makers, check out our website at www.dm.org. Follow us on Twitter at Disciple Makers, or find us on Facebook at facebook.com/Disciple Makers. Disciple Makers, reaching the campus, reaching the world.